Welcome to the Majlis, podcast of the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project at Queen's University. Majlis is the Arabic word for an assembly, literally a gathering of people sitting together, and it was used for the sessions of learned scholars, philosophers, intellectuals, and artists brought together to discuss and debate. Our podcast intends to accomplish the same purpose of bringing together experts and scholars for discussion and conversation about the politics, histories, cultures of the Middle East, Islamic world, and Muslim diasporas.
You can find the Majlis on your favorite podcast site, including Spotify and Apple iTunes. Don't forget to subscribe and let us know what you think by giving us a rating.
Salam, hello, bonjour. Welcome to the Majlis. I'm your host, Adnan Hussein, director of the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project. Back for another episode. We've had a bit of a hiatus, but we're looking forward to beginning a new series of podcast recordings, discussions, interviews, and the like for 2023. I hope everyone is having a wonderful start to this year. And I'm sure that people will be excited to listen to this episode because we have a very special guest. He's actually a producer for the Majlis podcast, but Shahroz is also a writer, a photographer, a researcher, focusing especially on gender and migration in the Global South. And he's currently a master's student here at Queen's University in the Global Development Studies Department, where he's completing his thesis on the kafala system and its neoliberal evolution in Lebanon. Now, for those of you who don't know, and if you don't, and perhaps you don't follow the World Cup or any of the controversies surrounding it, because Qatar as a host was pilloried really in the media for several years, and especially, of course, leading up in the months leading up to the World Cup because of its abusive migrant labor system known as the kafala system. But with almost 30 million migrants workers falling under it, the kafala system has become an extremely prominent part of labor and the labor organization of labor and systems of labor throughout the Global South. More recently, of course, as I just alluded, the kafala system has become a very prominent point of critique of labor and workers' rights in the Middle East, with constant comparisons of the kafala system to slavery. So we're going to have a conversation today with Shahroz about his thesis and about the kafala labor system. Welcome to the Majlis on this side of the mic, Shahroz.
Thank you so much for having me. This is my second time being on this side of the mic. First time it was the very first episode with Amel.
That's right.
And now that was at the very start of my journey in my master's. And now I'm here near the end of my journey with you, Dr. Zain. So thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, well, I'm excited to come, you know, to circle back to you and to talk about this important topic. Before we go much further, I mentioned a few things about the significance or importance of the kafala system, but maybe you can tell us a little bit more about what the modern kafala system actually is. How would you define and understand the kafala labor system?
Well, I think you gave a very good brief description of the kafala system. When we're talking about the modern kafala system, it is essentially a system that is used to monitor migrant laborers, primarily used in the Gulf country and others surrounding them, including Jordan and Lebanon. And it's really defined by a set of restrictive immigration laws, lack of regulations, and exploitative customary practices that ties a migrant a migrant worker's legal residency to their employer. So what what that amounts to is that such workers are frequently at risk of exploitation and abuse and are often excluded from national labor protection, including a requirement for minimum wage, limits on working hours, a weekly rest day, overtime pay, and a freedom of association and freedom to unionize. One thing that I really like to note about the kafala system is that it's primarily used to regulate blue-collar work in these countries, such as construction work, service work, and domestic work. And people who are hired under this system are primarily from Southeast Asia, South Asia, or Sub-Saharan Africa. In other words, it's a very racialized system where a white employee from Canada that would be employed by a business in Dubai, he wouldn't fall in the same conditions of kafala as the workers from these previously mentioned countries. So it's a very racialized system that exploits people from particular parts of the world. And that's why it's such a focus in my study as well.
Uh-huh. Can I ask you a couple things further about some of the specifics of what makes it kind of fall under this category of kafala? Because I would think that any foreign worker would have to be sponsored in some respect, either by the government or the company or the employer in some way, to come into, like, say, Qatar or UAE and so on. Is that the case, or is it only for certain categories of work, or only for workers coming from certain places? What is the procedure for somebody who's hired to work in an executive or financial aspect of some company based in, say, Abu Dhabi? And they're from, you know, a different country, either Canada or UK. How would they gain immigration? Do they have to have a sponsor?
So it actually works different country by country. Like, for instance, in most of the Gulf, and I could be wrong, but from my research and from what I remember, most of the Gulf countries, every foreign national has to have a sponsor, someone that's a native sponsoring them. Mm-hmm. But what that looks like and what those sponsors and how those sponsors treat the said employee is completely varies based on their race, ethnicity, and nationality, and gender, of course. Mm-hmm. But in other countries such as Lebanon, the kafala system is only used to bring in blue collar workers such as construction workers, domestic workers, and service workers. And it should also be noted in a country like Lebanon, kafala system does not apply to Arab labor, foreign Arab labor. It only applies to foreign non-Arab labor, such as from Africa or from South Asia or Southeast Asia.
Well, we'll come on to talking a little bit more about Lebanon and how it's different, in what respects it's similar or different from the other Gulf countries. But let's go back to the Gulf country situation, since I understand obviously most of the kafala laborers, mm-hmm. those working under the kafala system, are brought into the Gulf states, you know, UAE and Qatar, Bahrain, and mm-hmm. Oman, and so forth. But on those, are Arab workers also under the kafala system in the Gulf? Because I believe there are a lot of foreign workers from other Arab countries, for example, mm-hmm. from Lebanon. You know, there are people who work in the Gulf, a lot of Palestinians. I know lots of Egyptians, a huge number of Egyptians working in the Gulf in a variety of capacities, doing security and also, you know, sometimes even working in the police forces, it seems, mm-hmm. usually under a Qatari, say, or an Emirati kind of chief or captain, but they're like the frontline sort of policemen and things like that can often be from other Arab countries. Would they be under the kafala system as well in the Gulf?
Yes, so they would be under the kafala system as well. Mm-hmm. But it's as we go forward with this conversation, there's this, the evolution of kafala and how it evolved to mainly encompass what we see is non-Arab racialized workers is very interesting, especially this was a deliberate attempt to make sure the most of the labor that was coming to these Gulf countries was non-Arab. And they wanted to make sure to restrict this formation of pan-Arab, Arabism, pan-Arab identity that was causing a lot of social movements and more encouraging more labor rights in the 60s. And to prevent that specifically from forming and this idea of pan-Arab unity, which would have been resulted mostly in like most leftist and socialist ideologies, they brought in, they started focusing and bringing workers from South Asia, Southeast Asia, and more recently from Africa, because they knew they could, they didn't have to afford them any linguistic rights, any religious rights, any political rights, or any even social rights. So the system of the kafala that we see today, particularly in the Gulf countries, is set up in a way that it primarily recruits non-Arab foreign workers.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I mean, that reminds me of like the period when during the first Gulf War, for example, mm-hmm. You know, when Iraq occupied Kuwait, that there were an awful lot of Palestinians in mm-hmm. Kuwait who, you know, weren't really, you know, so concerned about Iraq, you know, taking Kuwait. They'd, you know, been mistreated, you know, yeah. working under bad conditions under the Kuwaitis, and they had maybe more pan-Arab, you know, kinds of sentiments. And I remember that being a big issue or and a problem. And that in the period after that, this is the early 90s, is yeah. in the period after that, it was, you know, a lot of the Gulf countries really discriminated against Palestinians and didn't want to hire many Palestinians because of their political orientation. You know, I think that caused some social problems. Yeah. So I think that's a really good point. It reminds me of that historical episode. So what we get, I think, from this is the idea that the kafala system is a system of sponsorship in which the conditions of labor are exempted from other legal regimes and really under the control of the employer to set. And that residency in the country is really contingent on having a sponsor. And you can't move, you don't have like a general work permit that would allow you to change employers, for example, if you didn't like the conditions in, you know, one situation, you couldn't, you know, then work in the same, you know, kind of industry or in the same category. You would not necessarily be able to switch employers. And so the kafala system, you know, gives enormous power to the employers. And this is what constitutes the abuse, is that the conditions of employment and immigration and residence into the jurisdiction, into the country, are all part of this labor system that exempts it from other sorts of laws. It's an intersection between immigration and employment that makes it so abusive. And of course, as far as I understand, there are a lot of stories about how these inequitable conditions that make it impossible for workers to seek other opportunities, to organize, to advocate for themselves, and even to stay in the country, if not at the behest of their employer, that there's huge numbers of abuses as a consequence of this.
Yeah, and in addition, what one of the ruling class of these Gulf countries, what they wanted to do was maintain power and maintain capital. And there was a lot of dissident growing from pan-Arab movements, including their own citizens that were from like Emiratis, like local Emiratis. They were partnering up, unionizing with Arabs from other countries. And to repress all of that and to make sure there was a diluted power, like laborer power within people who had any who had access to change, that could access change, they started relying on kafala system as the main way to create labor within their countries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. What would you say about these comparisons to slavery? you know, that have become so common to characterize it as modern day slavery. You know, how would you respond to that? Do you agree? Do you, what distinctions do you think should be made? How do you respond to those characterizations?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was actually reading an article about this yesterday, and one of the common critiques of the kafala system that comes from like this human rights perspective, this international liberal system, is that the kafala system has slave-like conditions, where when you're analyzing it based on material condition, perhaps there is a space for comparison there. When you're talking about indentured labor, mm-hmm. that is something I think would be more suitable for the conditions of kafala, perhaps not like bondage slavery that we tend to think of in our modern pop culture mindset, because whenever we think of slavery, we go back to the American version of slavery, right? Because that's just like as North Americans and as Westerners, that's the idea of slavery that's in our head. But when, so perhaps there is a need to expand the idea of what slavery is, but perhaps this idea of slavery within the kafala system is also, I think, somewhat reductive to the kafala system, and it doesn't take into account the modern realities of the labor system that has caused the kafala system. This isn't something, this isn't a relic of the 18th century or like the 8th century or the 7th century, right? This is something that is exclusively 21st century and created by the neoliberal economic system that we have at the global level. And unfortunately, to say it, to reduce it simply, oh, it's slavery, I think that takes away the accountability that the modern capitalist system has for creating that system in place, but also it also like creates this Middle Eastern exceptionalism where we look at anything that happens in the Middle East, whether it's like violence, whether it's religious intolerance, we tend to dramatize it and make sure we orientalize it in a way that's like, oh, of course it has to be such extreme there because it's the Middle East, right?
Right. And I think what they mean by that also is that it has to be some very brutal form of labor repression, which of course, you know, it is, but to make mm-hmm. it exceptional and to characterize it in terms of kind of the almost the medieval kind of survival of a slave system in the modern world, rather than seeing it as a product of modern labor conditions, is also because it's associated with Islam and Muslims, right? So why is it called the kafala system if it's, you know, not something unique and organic to the Muslim world, is probably how people think about it, because it's called kafala, which is an Arabic word. And so it must be grounded in Islamic law, is I think what maybe many people's associations or conclusions, you know, would be. But of course, you know, as people who are familiar at all with, you know, Sharia, Islamic law, would know, is that this word kafala essentially means a guardianship or sponsorship system, which originated in Islamic law, historically speaking, you know, to deal with somebody who would be a legal guardian, for example. Mm-hmm. They would be, somebody who can stand as surety for debts to be paid. If somebody is receiving a loan, part of the way they might guarantee in the conditions of the loan, because of course Islam forbids interest, but you know, you might still be concerned, like, if I give you the money, how will I get it back? And so there might be somebody who stands as a kafil, that is, as a surety, that if you, the person who's taking the loan, are unable to pay it back, that you will cover kind of the difference. And so it's a legal arrangement for standing surety, which exists in a lot of different legal systems, you know, globally and historically, this kind mm-hmm. of idea. And also another, you know, component of it is being somebody who will be vouch for and be responsible for someone's legal obligations. So one other example of that is If you're charged with a crime, but your trial is, you know, there's an investigation taking place and a trial is set for a future date, you know, a kafil is somebody who will kind of make sure and takes responsibility to make sure that, you know, you'll be in their care until you go, and they make sure that you will go to the court date, right? So it's a way of kind of deputizing legal responsibility or financial responsibility as a kind of substitute, as a sponsor, you know, for somebody. And those are the only aspects or ways in which it's used in Islamic law.
Yeah.
So I guess my question for you is, if it's not as a labor system, it's not an organic part, there isn't no any provision in Islamic law when it deals with labor relations that is the kafala system in within Islamic law. In fact, actually, Islamic law is very clear that you need to pay people properly. You know, you shouldn't, like, you know, let the sweat dry. There's a hadith from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam that says, like, you know, you should pay the laborer before his sweat dries, right? You know, it's like you're supposed to pay them right away. There are restrictions on employers and the ethics of how you would treat somebody who is working for you and for whom you're, you know, you're employing.
Exactly. So
the question is like, for you, since you're studying the kafala, the modern kafala system, is, well, what are its origins and how does it develop?
Yeah, I mean, you had, like, that was such a great way of summarizing the relevance of kafala system within the Islamic realm and Islamic jurisprudence. And just to build off of that, it's also kafala within the Islamic understanding. It provided, like, a framework of social solidarity based on trust and cooperation, right? That often guaranteed, like, a social safety net for vulnerable populations, particularly. If I'm a stranger traveling to a distant country, I could rely on the, like, this understanding of kafala that I would be taken care for in with someone, and they would provide surety for me that, like, this is a reliable person that you can do business with, and et cetera, et cetera. But what has happened now is that, so you're saying, how did it evolve from something like this to what we know it today?
And yeah, which was, like, part of, like, Arab tribal custom, like a stranger, exactly, as you were saying, a stranger comes, you know, you sponsor them, and, like, they're sort of temporarily part of your household within the tribal system, and you know, you give a guarantee. It's like it's a sponsorship guarantee that this person, you know, is as you said, reliable. And if something goes wrong, then I'm responsible for the person. That's really, you know, what it was in that system. So yes, indeed. How did we get from that, you know, into this, like, horribly oppressive labor regime?
Well, honestly, there is, the answer is very, it happens throughout the 20th century and late 19th and early 20th century. But the short answer is British imperialism. And British imperialism, particularly in the island of Bahrain and Kuwait, became a major catalyst in developing the kafala system in the region as a mean to regulate migrant labor and consolidate further power in the Indian Ocean. And so even though Bahrain and Kuwait were never formally British colonies, they were legally ruled as the same as any other colonial jurisprudence that the British had in Yemen, in India, and elsewhere. So, and the pre-oil economy of the region consisted of pearl diving, which attracted tens of thousands of migrants from the surrounding region during the harvest seasons, and particularly to the British-controlled areas of, like, Bahrain and Kuwait. And the colonial administration there, which produced more than half of the world's pearls, sought a way to regulate these waves of migrants in order to maximize economic growth, but, like, also simultaneously upholding the security of the colonial control and the imperial borders that they had set up. So right now, like, this is, the time frame is, like, late 19th century. There are no idea of borders. There's no idea of what a foreigner is. There's no idea of, like, what a migrant is. These are just people, like, neighbors that happen to come in during the harvest season, and then they go back after earning whatever they have earned. But the British, this was too complicated for the British to handle. They could not control them. They could not regulate them And they could, most importantly, they could not tax them because they didn't know how many people were coming, what were the profits being produced. So in order to do that, they relied on a local custom, which was known as kafala, as a surety. So what they would do is make sure each of the head of the ship, which would go to the for pearl diving, he would have to register any amount of foreign laborers that would come from outside their British-controlled regions, and make sure that the captain of that ship is responsible for every single person on that ship, and then they would be responsible to see that they would leave afterwards. If they stayed or if they did something else, the captain would be fined, right? And this really begins the inception of the modern kafala system in relation to regulating labor.
Fascinating. So they adapted a kind of institution or a practice, both in Islamic law and Arab tribal custom, that was really about, you know, hosting and offering protection and standing, you know, surety to facilitate these connections, into a way of monitoring, controlling, regulating labor movement and residency, basically, in British controlled areas.
And you can see how that created the system that we know today, because before the British came, there was no this idea of concrete borders and where like a particular country would end and another would begin, or like this is my land and that's your land. And like you were saying, the British took a local system that was known to the natives, and they used it in a way for their benefits. And they did that all over the world, right? With the caste system in India, with the religion in India, with other parts in Africa, using tribal ethnicities against each other. So it was just another way to make sure they had a monopoly on power within that region.
Well, I mean, we could say that they were amazing innovators, if we want to put it in those terms, in labor systems. Obviously, slavery, you know, in the transatlantic slavery and the plantation system was a particular kind. It wasn't unique to the British, but there were, slave plantations under the British in the Caribbean and the U.S. South, but then also indentured labor. Once the abolition of slavery took place, they evolved a new labor system to bring South Asians. And this is what they're doing too, also in the Gulf, is bringing a lot of South Asian laborers, but they brought them to the Caribbean, for example, as indentured laborers. And then they've also developed this kafala system, essentially using, as we've been talking about, local customs and structures, to monitor and control labor. So they're very inventive, in their form of colonialism, in using the local conditions and then changing them and altering them in new ways. Yeah.
And honestly, the study that I researched, there isn't a lot of, surprisingly, even though kafala is a huge part of the labor movement and the labor system in the global south, there is very little research that is done on its origin and how it originated. Because everyone in the academic field and also in mainstream media culture has adopted an understanding that the kafala labor system is a time everlasting system that came from ancient practices of the Arabs, and they've always had slaves and yada yada yada, right? And that is when we need to start questioning these histories that are presented to us. And even before I started this thesis that I'm almost finishing now, I had no idea that the British were primarily the instigators of the system as we know it today, because as I understood it as well, the kafala was a very Arab, uniquely Arab system. But doing more and more research on it, it's not very uniquely Arab at all, even as the way it's practiced today.
Right. I mean, so that's sort of what we were alluding to, is that there is a lot of Orientalism in how the kafala system is understood and characterized. And that's even the case, as you're pointing out, among scholars who research the kafala system. They're more concerned with the contemporary conditions, and they don't always know or investigate the history. I mean, I read to prepare for this, I read one article, and you're right, there's not a lot. I went looking for works, historical studies and investigations. I came across Omar Hisham Ashahabi's article, Policing Labor and Empire, The Modern Origins of the Kafala Sponsorship System in the Gulf Arab States. It's a very good article, but it's almost alone as a piece of scholarship that really looks into the origins beyond, you know, just characterizations of the contemporary system, but really, you know, how did it develop?
Exactly. And Al-Shahabi's article, it was only written in 2019. So that's only like less than 4 years ago, right?
Right.
And even though this system of labor has been like under academic scrutiny since early 2000s, from what I remember. Mm-hmm. But no one has managed, like, focus on doing any research. And since Al-Shahabi's article came out, there hasn't been any new development in it as well. So it's like you were saying, it's like the lone article and research that really characterizes the true history of how the kafala became into a labor system that we know today.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I mean, those are the origins. So it's obviously really starting in Bahrain, and then it spreads to some of the other pearl diving industry in the Gulf. So, you know, from Bahrain to, you know, Qatar and, you know, what becomes Kuwait and so on, and the Emirates. But your thesis is about the kafala system in Lebanon. So I wondered if maybe you might talk a little bit about what your research has been on how it was imported into Lebanese society, under what conditions, how it changed, what's similar and what's different to the way in which the kafala system operates in the Gulf states.
Yeah, so part of the reason why I became even interested in the idea of kafala in Lebanon was because from my understanding, the kafala system was in the Gulf because they were rich and they could afford it. And Lebanon is not the most economically stable country that is in the region right now. And it hasn't been for a while since the onset of the civil war. There's been a lot of economic ups and downs in Lebanon. And my interest really became as to why this system was in Lebanon in the first place. It's just a small country of only, I think, like 4 million people. And it did not need something like a kafala system to make its society organized. However, what I found from my research, I found out that the kafala system is not really native to Lebanon in the same sense that it is native to Bahrain or Kuwait, as in like the product of the late 19th century. In Lebanon, it's a very modern adaption that began at the end of the Civil War in the early 1990s. And that became... that only became prominent as a result of the Lebanese connection with the Gulf, because the Gulf countries, particularly UAE and Saudi Arabia, they had a huge role in restructuring Lebanon's economy in the post-war era. And one of the inspirations that Lebanon got from it was making sure they're going to be recruiting cheap laborers to do work such as domestic work and construction work and service work. And that's the only place where kafala is used within Lebanon. If a white employee were to go to Lebanon for a financial opportunity, they would not need something as the kafala certificate. They would just need to apply for a regular work visa, and that's it. They would be eligible to enter the country. But for a woman from Sri Lanka, in order for her to work in a domestic setting in Lebanon, they have to go through the kafala system.
Right. Yeah, that's something I noticed, in the 2000s, traveling in the region, that in Jordan and Lebanon, there were a lot of domestic workers from places like Sri Lanka, principally from Sri Lanka in those contexts. Whereas in the Gulf, the labor recruitment is from a pretty broad variety of mm-hmm. countries, a lot of Bengalis, of course, Sri Lankans, Filipinos, but a lot of other, you know, Indians. You know, recently when I was in Qatar, I met, you know, Kashmiris. I met people from across South Asia and, of course, a lot of sub-Saharan Africans, especially Kenyans, you know, working in a place like Qatar. Whereas in Lebanon, it sounds like it's fairly specific. It's more limited in terms of where they work and in what kinds of contexts, and also where they're being recruited from. It seems a little bit narrower.
So in Lebanon, actually, the like 70% of the like in we're talking about stats from 2015. 70% of the people that come through the kafala system are women. And they're coming, and 90% of those women are employed only in the domestic work setting, right? So what that creates is a gender imbalance and a very gendered system that has very like problems regarding sexual abuse, emotional abuse, sexual harassment. These are very common practices that are associated with the kafala system in Lebanon. It's actually reported that within Lebanon, two domestic workers attempt suicide every week.
Wow, that's incredible, that statistic.
Yeah, and that's the reason why I even became interested in studying this story of Lebanon, because I was just curious as to how did this country that just came out of a civil war have the means to develop such a expansive labor network that expands from Philippines all the way to Kenya now as well. And in Lebanon, there is actually a classification of employees hierarchy depending on their desirability, and the more desirable an employee is, the more they're worth. So a Filipino woman would be the highest in terms of what they would get paid. Then it would be a sub-Saharan African worker, and then it would be a South Asian worker. And those are the least desirable workers within the context of domestic work in Lebanon. And usually people who are like families who cannot afford to get a Filipino worker, they would settle for getting a Sri Lankan worker. And that's how racialized and gendered system, the kafala system has become within the context of Lebanon as well, which I expand on further in chapter 2 and chapter 3 within my thesis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, in fact, actually, that makes me curious. What exactly does your thesis cover in your analysis of and study of the kafala system in Lebanon? So besides this gendered component of the labor force that's been recruited, what other kinds of research questions are you dealing with and topics are you covering?
Yeah, well, I really wanted to ground my research within a historical framework that was really rooted in a critique of neoliberal capitalism as it has operated within the global operated within the global economy since the 1980s. And Lebanon is a primary example of how neoliberal restructuring of the economy has created a need for a global reserve of laborers that Lebanon is addicted to basically now, because they have this cheap reserve of labor that they can recruit from other countries for a relatively low amount of price. And that makes it that has accustomed to a certain lifestyle that certain Lebanese families have do not want to give up anymore. So I started my research from a very historical perspective of how the kafala system began, and then what were its evolution within the context of the throughout the 20th century, and then how it got to Lebanon. And from there, I continue my analysis on the gendered impacts of the kafala system within the modern setting in the early 21st century, and then the racialized impacts of the kafala system in the early 21st century as well. Of course, my thesis is only a master's thesis, and I'm attempting to cover a lot of topic, but I really wanted to give a summary or a starting point for people to really understand how the kafala system has been operating within Lebanon, and what are some of its impact that are visible now, because As anyone that's seen the news regarding labor regimes in Lebanon, the kafala is very prominent in the news in regards to Lebanon and how it's responsible for mass suicides of workers across the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess we have to think about these conditions. I mean, because they're in a particular regime that doesn't apply, there aren't any of the other protections that apply mm-hmm. to people coming on a regular work visa as a foreign mm-hmm. worker in Lebanon, that they're exempted from those. It's really very much in the hands of the employer. Yeah. And again, their presence in the country is contingent upon that sponsorship by a particular employer. So they can't change
exactly,
you know, households or look for work in another context. And so then, you know, as I remarked earlier, this gives the employer extraordinary power over the worker that you've mentioned, then leads to all kinds of abuse and some of it about gendered sexual violence and harassment yeah. as well. Under such conditions, I suppose you could understand that they're cut off from family, very far away from their mm-hmm. home countries. They don't have any local connections and resources. Their whole existence in the country is predicated upon working in this particular household as a domestic servant. And they're probably, you know, have family who depends on remittances. I imagine that's a big part of it as well, is that their wages are lower, but nonetheless, they still have to exist in Lebanon and try and either save or, you know, send money home. Yeah. And this must be a real struggle.
And yeah, and actually that creates another element to this whole idea of like labor regimes that are so exploitative throughout the neoliberal system of globalization, because it's not just Lebanon that is doing this, right? It's also Canada that relies on exploitative conditions and these temporary work visas, as they call them here. I mean, it's just a kafala system by another name, in my opinion, because it's the same system over here where a worker comes to Canada and they can only rely on their employers to give them residency within Canada. And if they try to leave the employer because of exploitative conditions, any abuse or harassment, their case is not really heard by any of the courts in Canada. Right, it's usually subjected to, oh, it's a private labor matter, and they're not the temporary labor workforce within Canada does not even have the same legal protections that we as Canadians do. So it's pretty much a neoliberal global problem that relies on the vulnerability of certain countries and certain people from certain countries.
Yes, exactly. I mean, this is what I was thinking about as well, is that there are a lot of parallels with other labor systems. So your point that it's actually maybe the whole is the same labor system, or at least there are kafala-like conditions happening around the world because neoliberalism exploits not only the free movement of capital, but also labor, but under certain conditions, right? Yeah. That's the whole point, is that they don't want these laborers to be able to have citizenship rights. I mean, that's the reason why Canada has this temporary worker program, principally, I think, for agricultural labor, like in southern Ontario and some of the mm-hmm. large scale industrial agriculture, facilities. I wouldn't call them farms because they're no. really labor. They're more
they're
like
not farms.
Right, exactly. And so the importing a lot of Caribbean labor, for example, but under conditions where they don't have the ability to organize, they don't have any health care, right? Mm-hmm. Their residence is restricted to employment to a particular employer.
And this is like all very attractive to a neoliberal government as well, because yeah. what this means is like, there's no legal limits on working hours. There's no legal limits on minimum mm-hmm. wages, no benefits, and a lack of access to labor ministries that are set to protect workers' rights. So that creates a perfect set of conditions for large corporations to have freedom of movement and a freedom to exploit any labor population that they want from the world and still being able to make record profits.
Yes. So when we began this conversation, we talked a little bit about the kafala system as this, you know, unique, you know, system that developed in the, you know, Gulf states. When will you do analysis, I guess, in your thesis and the kind of historical and contemporary research, it clarifies in some ways that while the kafala system may be a very abusive and oppressive system for labor migration, for foreign, you know, migrant workers in a society, this system really is neoliberalism at work, and we find similar kinds of systems operating even in the first world, in the neoliberal globalized economy, and that we shouldn't really, while we're critical of this abusive labor practice, it's not really very fair to associate it exclusively with the Arab Middle East or the Gulf states as a form of the persistence of slavery. What you're suggesting, it seems, is that slavery is part of the neo, I mean, if you want to call it in that loose sense of slavery. I mean, you know, whether it's sweatshop work or whether it's these kinds of, you know, cutouts, indentured labor, and temporary work visas, and kafala, we're talking about a global neoliberal labor system that is operating.
Exactly. And that's why, like, I firmly wanted to root my research within a neoliberal understanding of how the global economy has been restructured to make sure labor is like the primary resource that is being exploited. And the market for this is international now. It's not just restricted to, corporations aren't just restricted to borders. They have the whole world in their hands, and they can recruit from wherever they want, giving them unlimited access to vulnerable populations. And that has not only driven down the wages in all countries, but it has also created a whole system of vulnerable populations within each countries that virtually have no protection for even going back home to their own countries anymore.
Well, Shahroz, I got to really thank you for coming on to the Majlis and talking about your fascinating and very important research. I look forward to reading the thesis at some point soon. I wish you the best in finishing the writing and in completing it, but hopefully you will continue with you know, some further work in this field, since you're taking a perspective, I think, that is invaluable in really contextualizing, historicizing, and analyzing these regimes of labor and migration, and especially the gendered component in a place like Lebanon. So thanks so much for joining us.
For sure. Thank you so much for having me here. I'm honored to talk about it. This really is something important to me, because my grandfather used to be a kafala worker as well in Dubai. So it's something, I have a personal history with it. But also, I think, like, this lack of there is a lack of understanding of how the kafala system is still a product of a very modern product of the system that we all have in our country right now, and that we're upholding through our governments. So I'm honored to talk about it, and I'm honored to share the thesis with your listeners once it's complete in the next coming weeks.
Oh, fantastic. And it's great to hear how it has a personal meaning as well. I mean, that's a really insightful, you must bring some different insights and different feeling to the research, having that history. So I appreciate you sharing that. And so thanks again. And listeners, look forward to future episodes. We've kicked off our new season for 2023. This is the first episode in what we hope will be an interesting series on a whole variety of topics related to the Middle East, Islamic world, as well as Muslim diasporic experience in North America and Europe, and an interdisciplinary variety of topics coming to the Majlis. So stay tuned. And for now, all the best. and salam, and have a great week, and we look forward to welcoming you back to the Majlis very soon.
Thank you for joining us in the Majlis, a podcast by MSGP. Muslim Society's Global Perspectives, or MSGP, is an initiative at Queen's University dedicated to connecting the complex history of Islamic societies with the contemporary world. You can connect, learn more, and support us by checking out our website, www.queensu.ca/MSGP, and stay up to date with our events by following us on Twitter at MSGPQU and on our Facebook, MSGPQU. You can also follow our YouTube channel, The Majlis.